Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 317 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the 18th instalment of our Location and the Writer series, Sid Moore takes us to the liminal spaces of the Essex estuary, where land and sea meet and mingle. Then Amanda Dalton reconsiders Coventry, the place where she grew up that has now become less a place on a map than a state of mind. First, here's Sid Moore on the Essex estuary.
On the 1st of September 2010, I attended a salon at Chookwell Hall, the Essex headquarters of the arts organisation Metal. It is a beautiful Grade 2 listed building in a Victorian park with stunning views of the Thames estuary, and so provided a fitting backdrop for a talk by the writer Ken Walpole. Walpole's work ranges across literary criticism, architecture and landscape aesthetics, and it was the latter that he had come to speak about, specifically his book 350 Miles, An Essex Journey. This was the culmination of a project he conceived with the photographer Jason Orton. Together, the pair walked and cycled our county's shoreline, writing passionately about the beauty of the often maligned coastal paths, the seascapes, skies and fortifications. That evening, I was particularly taken by one of Walpole's comments, that the estuary was a mirror, that when you stood and looked into that olive-green body of water, it threw back at you your own mood and showed you how you were feeling. Although I had an innate sense of what Walpole was talking about, I have never heard anyone articulate it quite like that before. It resonated profoundly. You see, the estuary has always been a large part of my life, from my childhood spent on the sunny beaches of Southend to these strange, current, uncharted times in which it offers an escape from lockdown. It has been there always, as Walpole observed, reflecting my moods, feelings and dreams. Its salty water has filtered into much of my writing, often appearing as a character who charts the psyche of protagonists as they move through my novels. And I am not the only one. A myriad of writers have tried to capture and categorise this river, estuary and sometimes sea. However, it is slippery, unpindownable, and mischievously displays different characteristics at various parts of its journey. At its beginning, the River Thames curls past Rainham Marshes and straightens to greet Essex at Purfleet. The Long Reach, as this stretch is called, is populated with sewage works and industrial parks. It is muddy, stark, and brooding. An aesthetic brutality exists in the landscape. The sky here is huge and deep, full of weather. My father was an inspector on Essex Police's Sea Rescue, which kept watch over Southend seafront during the 70s and 80s. He patrolled the Long Reach in 1989, when the caissons for the Queen Elizabeth Bridge were sunk. These foundations had to be laid in the 30-minute window of slack water at low tide. It fell to him and his crew to keep other vessels away. Today, a ceaseless flow of traffic crawls over the bridge, packing the air with fumes, amplifying the frenetic energy. This atmosphere, however, cannot be a recent phenomenon. Over 100 years ago, Bram Stoker also looked into these waters and made the decision to locate Carfax House here. This was the property sold to Count Dracula by Jonathan Harker in Stoker's Gothic classic. Described as in places gloomy, with a deep, dark-looking pond. Other attractions included a private lunatic asylum next door, which contained the feverish Renfield, tended to by Dr. Jack Seward. Purfleet, with its length of light swallowing water, was evidently the perfect mirror for a vampire with a disposition to the shade and the shadow. Past the bend at Tilbury Docks, another literary great, Joseph Conrad, moored the Nelly, a small ship carrying the unnamed narrator of Heart of Darkness, and Marlowe, who recounts his journey into another river, the Congo. Conrad once lived in this vicinity and used the liminal vista to foreshadow the moral corruption that the seamen encountered. "The air was dark above Gravesend," he wrote, "and farther back still seemed condensed into a mournful gloom. brooding motionless over the biggest and the greatest town on earth, London's gateway to the world. As an angst-ridden teenager, I could relate to this and would often take myself to the Thorpe Bay beach shelters on cloudy days, where I would find solace in the rhythm of the waves, the grey seam on the horizon where the water met the sky, and the passing of vessels in the shipping lane. Sure, it was bleak, but as Conrad also outlined, the estuary symbolised movement too, the possibility of travel, adventure, a route out of the parochial into the unknown. Just a few miles downriver from Tilbury is the flat and marshy Canvey Island. Here, Charles Dickens situated another escape, the botched attempt of Magwitch in the epic novel Great Expectations. Local legend holds that the writer stayed at the Lobster Smack Inn, which remains in its original state. Today, however, a large seawall circles the island, erected after the 1953 floods, which claimed the lives of 59 islanders. A constant sense of threat, married with the unpredictability of the estuary, is strongly felt along this northern fringe. My hometown of Lee-on-Sea stands on cliffs looking across to the Nore Sands, the Yanklet Flat and the Sheerness Middle Sand, where on the 20th of August 1944 the SS Montgomery ran aground. Still visible at low tide, the warship was packed with explosives that no one has ever been able to make safe. My father often comments on the tricky nature of this strait, believing if you can manage a vessel through the estuary, you can navigate anywhere in the world. It's certainly a treacherous patch. We all know of local fishermen who've lost their lives and regularly hear news of walkers who have been caught out on the mud. This undercurrent of menace was something I put to play in my first novel, The Drowning Pool. The plot revolved around Sarah Moore, the alleged sea witch of Lee, who was, I discovered, just a poor old woman, twice widowed, once by the estuary. But Essex is often not identified with peril, but pleasure, and nowhere more so than the day tripper's seaside resort of Southend-on-Sea. There's a lot of snobbery attached to this cheerful and boisterous town, with its kiss-me-quick hats, fish and chips, carnival rides and amusement arcades. I suspect this is due to its working-class nature, as it is constantly presented as such by filmmakers, musicians and artists. Daphne du Maurier gifted it to her eponymous heroine in the short story Maisie. To the weary London prostitute, it was an idyllic fantasy where she saw golden sands and a wide stretch of sea. There's little boats too, with brown sails, and there's donkeys with ribbons in their ears. Just before it opens out to the North Sea, the estuary passes the final island in the Essex archipelago, Foulness. Much of this mystery isle is owned by the MOD and forbidden to the public. Creatives and thinkers intrigued by the Shroud of Secrecy have been drawn to it over the years, most recently Robert McFarlane. The nature writer walked the parallel path to the island across the Maplin Sands. The Broomway, McFarlane attested, is the unearthliest place I have ever walked. He likened the terrain to a dazzling mirror world. This time, though, he did not refer to metaphor, but the physical reflective qualities of water over sand and under sky. Unlike other writers inspired to capture the desolate beauty of earlier sections, this part of the estuary, ironically the most hazardous of all, evoked serenity in McFarlane. The space through which we moved calmed me to the point of invulnerability, he wrote in The Old Ways. We walked out of Doggerland, off the mirror and onto the sea wall. For days after, I felt calm, level and flat. Doggerland, in case you were interested, is the sunken Mesolithic continent that once formed a land bridge from the east of Britain to mainland Europe. Above it, the inner estuary ends and the tide finally flows into the open sea. It is astonishing, really, that one body of water has stirred so many disparate responses. An Arcadia, a threat, a frightening backwater, a symbol of adventure and activity, a place of tranquility and contemplation. The beauty of the estuary is clearly in the eye of the beholder. as Walpole said that evening 10 years ago, when we look into its mirror, each of us sees something that, just like us, is utterly unique.
That was Sid Moore, recorded by herself. You can find out more about Sid on her website at sidmoore.com. That's Sid, spelt S-Y-D, and Moore, spelt M-O-O-R-E. Next, here's Amanda Dalton on Coventry.
To be ignored, ostracised, treated as if invisible. To be sent to Coventry. Coventry is the city of my birth, my childhood, my adolescence, and I hated it. So I always thought that the saying, being sent to Coventry, was an effective punishment for any miscreant. I must have done something terribly wrong in a former life to find myself there. Poor Coventry. My mum and Nan had lived through the war in the house I grew up in. By all accounts, they seemed to have spent most of their time in the cupboard under the stairs. They survived the relentless air raids, the Blitz of 1940. The city did not. In just one night, two-thirds of its buildings were destroyed or badly damaged, including the cathedral that was to become an icon of remembrance and rebirth. Growing up, I knew these stories, and I loved the ruined cathedral, but I couldn't love Coventry. Looking back on it now, I think what I really disliked was crowds, detritus, the grey concrete slabs of post-war rebuild. I wanted to be a country girl, a country boy, in fact. To be striding through fields, jeans tucked in my wellies, nature badges patterning my jacket. I wanted to be hand-milking cows on my uncle's farm in Wales, climbing trees, spotting birds through my junior telescope and ticking them off in my I Spy book. I wanted the woods and the empty coast, rock pools, tiny crabs, giant waves, and dizzying mountains, wide rivers. I wanted wilderness. I guess I was a hopelessly romantic child. I was also school phobic, and despite appearances, terrified of many things. So Coventry was Ulsdon Infant and Junior School, the towering edifice I refused to enter. Coventry was the fear that hung in the air of its disinfected buildings, that crept through the sour milk left in the sun in crates, lingered in the cheap rubber pumps on other children's feet as they climbed the wool bars. Coventry was the frightening streets I ran through as I bolted from the classroom, the dreams of a figure at my back, the teacher who was 12 foot tall, hooking me down from the ceiling with her reaching stick. Coventry was locking myself in the bathroom for hours. And Coventry was the days and years at the child guidance clinic where they tested my IQ and stared at me and asked about my dreams and wrote things down while I played with toy animals in a pit of sand. We lived in a terraced house in the suburb of Ulsdon, on a road that killed three of my beloved cats, but was at least tree-lined, and did lead, as long as I turned left from our gate, to the common and the woods and the wide-open memorial park. And our house was safe, and Ulsdon had a library. Those three places formed a kind of triangle of space that made Coventry intimate, knowable, home. To this day, the world inside that triangle is the location of many of my dreams and of the images that come to me when I write. Those places made my love of books, of nature, of being around home. If I were to draw a map of my childhood Coventry, that triangle would be at the centre. My map would bear no resemblance to a street plan of the city, would have little to do with the objective facts of its road systems, its distances, its landmarks. I'm reminded of that Herman Melville quote, "It is not down in any map. True places never are." My Coventry is a kind of imaginative reconstruction based on feeling. It's a state of mind. I don't remember at what age it stopped being cool to love animals and the countryside, when going to Ulsdon Common became more about sex than watching birds. when I started messing about with Ouija boards with my friends, so the woods I had to walk past to get home at night were suddenly much too dark. But somehow I grew up in Coventry and was kind of happy there. I laughed a lot, went to a normal secondary school, rode my bike the long way home via Charles Moor to pass the house of the teacher I adored, skived PE with my friends in the Wimpy Bar, and lost hours and hours in the Midland Educational, a book and art shop in the City Arcade, where I especially loved the shelves of turquoise-spined Pelican paperbacks. I acted out my religious phase in Coventry at the beautiful Holy Trinity Church, and in plays at the new and old cathedrals. Spent years pretending to like the city centre because the city centre was where it was at. Meeting a boyfriend at the Hotel Leofric Bar, going to the pricey hairdresser for a dodgy perm, crashing a party in a seedy flat off Albany Road where my parents never knew I'd been. But the streets were still ugly to me, the subways dangerous, the people too many. When I think of the city centre of Coventry, I don't think of Lady Godiva's statue or Holy Trinity Church where my parents' ashes lie, or waiting for the bus in Broadgate. I think of holding my breath. Perhaps I did, for a long time. At the other end of Earlsdon is another common, Hirsel Common, where the fair came once or twice a year. There was litter on Hirsel Common, worn grass, stray dogs, but it was open, windy, good for flying kites, and I loved the fair. As I think of it now, Hirsel Common seems to sit with drinking Newcastle Brown on the street, hanging out with the rough gang, the girl who borrowed my Tamla Motown singles, then denied she'd ever had them. Hirsel Common is the days I wore a Crombie, J-Tech shirts and Wranglers. What was I thinking? I guess I was trying to find out who I was, trying the suede heads on for size. On another day with other people, I'd be lolling on a beanbag in loons or tie-dyeing T-shirts in the bath listening to Tubular Bells. In truth, like most teenagers, I had no idea who I was. Seemed to be a bit of everyone. But probably felt safest being middle of the road. Or wishing I was still that kid in wellies and an old shirt, rescuing animals that didn't need rescuing, climbing trees. In 2004, years after I'd left Coventry, my mum died. After her funeral, my big brother and sister and I drove to Earlsdon. We wanted to see our old house. We were probably loitering, the owners appeared, and they were the same couple who'd bought the house from my mum when she'd moved away in the 80s, a few years after the sudden death of my dad. They were lovely, insisted we went in, had a cup of tea. They invited us to wander round alone. It was the strangest experience, a little like one of my dreams coming to life. I felt as if I was reading the house, as if it was what Gaston Bachelard calls a psychological diagram. When we left, we walked down the street that Mrs. Ramby's sweet shop was on, looked for the sloping alleyways at the backs of houses where I used to play hide and seek and race my trolley cart. We went to the common, and I ran on my own into the trees, down the old familiar path to the steep slopes of Devil's Dungeon, where our gang would dare to ride our bikes, through the thick undergrowth where the flasher used to lurk, past the place beside the busy Kenilworth Road, where my ollie dog bolted one day, chasing a scent, and miraculously was not hit by a car. Nostalgia made me love everything about Coventry that day. I haven't lived there for 40 years, but in so many ways it's the place that made me. And of course I've made it, my skewed, partial version of a city that in truth I hardly knew. All my life I've had vivid flashbacks of moments I've spent in particular places, people's kitchens, hillsides, car parks, at sea. I remember the where of things, the location sometimes sharper than the event, but always charged with emotion, with the feeling of what happened there. Coventry is flooded with it.
That was Amanda Dalton, recorded by Yasir Amir. You can find out more about Amanda on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 317, which was produced by Yasir Amir and Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 318, Cherise Saywell speaks with Doug Johnston about discovering writing, her strong sense of place, clean prose, and stories versus novels. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.